Isn't he 6'5"?
Is he? Because I googled Haaland's height, but it gives it you in meters, so I've converted it.
yeah, that's a fair point, isn't it?
So it's 1.9 meters.
It says 6'4". 1.94 meters or 6'4".
So Transfermarkt's got him as 1.95 meters.
Ooh.
And in feet.
That might tip him. That'll tip him over then, won't it? That's
6'4". It's definitely 6'3", definitely too short.
Ah, you know what I've done? When you put it into Google, it says 6.3.
9'7".
Yeah. So 6.3 feet tall isn't 6'3". There we go. Right, okay.
Yeah.
So what are we going with? 6'5"?
No, 6.39 feet. So it's 6 foot. If you're rounding up, it's 6'4".
Yeah, it's 6'4".
Okay, we'll go with 6'4" then.
This is Blue Moon. It's the original fan-made Manchester City podcast. Coming up, we've got news and views from City's week. It's your club, and this is your show.
If the Premier League win at Bournemouth was a bit of a tense affair, then the FA Cup victory at Luton was anything but. It's funny how a 6'4", 88-kilo battering ram smashing the ball into the net 5 times can lift the mood a little, isn't it? We'll be reviewing both of those games on today's Blue Moon podcast. Plus, it's that time of the season again, so soon. The Manchester Derby is back upon us, so we'll be looking ahead to that. It's also nearly 20 years since the first time City met United at Eastlands, so Sam Rosbottom's here to cast a nostalgic eye over that win from 2004. And with the second leg of the tie with Copenhagen to preview as well. On top of that, we're going to take a look at some special lines of commentary delivered over City games. There's been a sense that City often get a bit of a raw deal from those on the mic, so we're going to celebrate the moments that have stayed with us down the years. All of that on the way, so let's introduce the guests. I'm David Mooney. With me this week is City fan Joe Butterfield.
Hi, how's it going?
Not too bad, thanks, Joe. And from Sporting News, Dom Farrell.
Hello, mate. I was all right till I found out that I am currently weighing a little bit more than Erling Haaland, who's about twice my height, so that's good for the ego.
Oh God, yeah, I'd not even thought about that. I weigh a lot more than him, but there we go. We're recording this on the 29th of February, which is the leap day. Do either of you two know the City player that holds the Premier League record for the only player that was born on the 29th of February to score a Premier League hat-trick?
That is the most obscure stat I can possibly imagine.
Don't say I never do my research. Yeah, yeah.
I have no idea whatsoever. Paolo Wanchope?
Literally just name someone who scored a Premier League hat-trick. You got Paolo a chance. It's not Wanchope. No, the Costa Rican god is not the hat-trick scorer from the 29th February.
Erling Haaland.
It's not Erling Haaland. It's not his birthday. It's Ferran Torres. There you go.
Right.
Yeah.
Wow.
Remember him.
Yeah, remember him. Newcastle away. Scott Carson played. That was the headline. Let's talk about the games with Luton and Bournemouth then. This episode of the Blue Moon podcast is sponsored by Green King Sport, where football is more than a game. Green King Sport venues are showing every single televised City fixture over the 23-24 season. So that means if you're not going to the Manchester Derby this weekend, you can catch it in a Green King Sport pub. And that goes for the Copenhagen game in midweek as well. And with more than 900 sports pubs across the UK, it doesn't matter where you're based, you can see every single minute of the action. If you download the Green King Sport app, you won't just get 10% off all drinks anytime there's a match on TV, but this month there's also thousands of pints of free Guinness to be won and the chance to win one of 6 holidays. Let's start then with the week that was, really, Dom, because it's a difficult one, this, to group these games together because they were just so different in terms of performances. What's your read on how City are playing at the moment?
That's a very good question. I don't know if I spoke to you about this previously or during the games or whatever, but there's an awful lot of coverage of City at the moment that is, oh, the big run's about to happen. And if you look at across all competitions, 16 wins out of 18 undefeated with 2 draws, it's happening, isn't it?
It kind of looks like it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
If it sounds like a duck and quacks like it, what's the phrase? It's not if it sounds like a duck and quacks like a duck. That's the same thing. What am I talking about? Yeah, it's walk like a duck and talk like a... No, that's not right either.
Walk like a duck and quack like a duck.
Yes, that's it.
Yeah. If the duck talks, that's exciting, isn't it? anyway, yeah, so it's... undoubtedly, if you have a scan down soccer base or your football database online of choice, there's just a big line of W's and no defeats in the 6th of December. So they must be playing great. But I tell you what, those four Premier League games before the Luton FA Cup game, Everton, Chelsea, Brentford, Bournemouth, all pretty stodgy, weren't they? Mm. And are these two away games at Copenhagen and Luton where everyone was treated to half an hour of Jack Grealish before his groin pinged, is that all a mirage? Is that how important is Grealish and all that? I think Grealish was fundamental to how they started against Copenhagen, probably less so against Luton. But yeah, it's funny to say, it's hard to get a read on how a team that have won 16 out of 18 in an unbeaten run are playing. But before the Luton game, I'd have said not well. I think this is the sort of thing that if anyone outside of the City bubble listened to it, would think this is the most ridiculous bit of navel gazing you ever heard. But there is no doubt that over the prior to the Luton game, you were thinking, this doesn't look great. And also, that's the other side of this long, long run is it's not resulted in pulling clear at the top of the league because Liverpool and Arsenal are both playing very well. Mm. And I think we're getting into that time of the season where you judge your team's performances by their title rivals. And, you know, Arsenal are that incredible thing where they become the first ever Premier League team to score at least two goals in seven consecutive halves of football, which is kind of mad. And obviously Liverpool are on a bit of a roll with, because Jurgen Klopp's invented picking young players or something. So yeah, I think City's form exists in that context. So it was handy to have the, from City's point of view, it was handy to have that goal glut at Luton because that's what the other two have been doing, and City have kind of been existing in binary before that.
Yeah. It's interesting, Joe, as well, because like Dom says, performance-wise, you look at the game at Luton. I don't know if Luton played into City's hands or City were just really, really good, one or the other, or maybe a bit of both, you know. And then you look at Bournemouth, it was, like Dom says again, really, really stodgy. Possibly because of the way Bournemouth set up and the way that they frustrated City, and possibly because City were out of sorts. I mean, I think I heard at one point Guardiola's instructions on about 80 minutes at Bournemouth was, you know, start the car. We got to get out of here, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's been an odd one. I think I agree with pretty much everything that Dom said there in terms of like the recent performances and stuff. But the Luton game felt like quite a departure from the previous ones in the sense that we had a lot of chances to score. And despite the way that we've been playing in those previous games, we have had chances to score. It's just that for whatever reason, whether it's Haaland not having his shooting boots on at the moment, well, obviously until Luton, or just a simple case of other teams defending quite well, we've had our chances to score. And on Luton, it just felt like we took most of the chances that we had. Obviously, Haaland, like a lot of the shots that he had that were... I think recently he's been sort of hitting the ball. He's been more focused because he's had a couple of games where he hasn't scored at all. I think the Chelsea game in particular probably hit him pretty hard in terms of having all those chances to put one away and didn't really do it. It felt like against Bournemouth that he was more just focused on maybe hitting the shot on target just to get that sort of I'm hitting shots on target confidence in the game rather than anything else.
I know, poor Tim Krul. Like there were so many that went through him, but at such a speed that they might have killed him if they caught him right.
Absolutely, yeah. So when it came to Luton, he was hitting him on target, but he was also absolutely smashing him to the point where it was like you do well to keep him out. So I think it's the Luton game. I think they did kind of play into our hands because I expected Luton, particularly at Luton, to really do what they've been doing in the league and just sort of like bunker down, make it a really physical battle and just sort of, you know, give City something that they're not really necessarily comfortable with to worry about. But instead, they played quite open, really. It was strange to sort of see us carving through the defence in a way that we haven't done with a lot of other against a lot of other teams who are quite happy to... It's been a bit of sort of a feature of City full stop is that, you know, we see so many teams sit back and sort of put 10 men behind the ball. And as much as 9 times out of 10, we will eventually find a way through and win those games. Realistically, your best chance of beating City is putting 10 men behind the ball and then just hoping for a lucky break or a counter. Luton just didn't do that, which, maybe they're just not as fussed about the FA Cup. And obviously with what's going on in the league for them, that's probably not necessarily a bad shout for them. But yeah, the Bournemouth game isn't... The Luton game feels like it's a bit of an isolated game in the context of the last month or so, whereas the Bournemouth game feels more like part of a pattern of performances that we've seen over the last month. And hopefully, you know, going into a game this weekend, which we'll get into later in the pod, a game this weekend where the team we're playing against are sort of conceding shots for fun. Hopefully we can sort of turn what we've seen in the FA Cup this week into something that we actually see again in the league as well.
Yeah. Let's talk about Haaland, Dom, because he's become the first player to score 5 for City on 2 separate occasions. And he's only, it's been a season and a half. It's ridiculous already. He hasn't felt as inevitable in front of goal this season. So I wonder how much he needed a night like Tuesday, you know?
Yeah, massively. because I think after the third minute or whatever it was when he opened the scoring, he quickly felt pretty inevitable again. And then how much is that inevitability tied to being the same team as De Bruyne? Because, you know, there's been lots of things you guys have gone over on the podcast, like from the problems of Gundogan not being around anymore to balance of the team, control versus the more attacking players in there. The signings last summer, maybe not all completely gelling, but is it as simple as City have missed a combined 7 months of De Bruyne and Haaland? And now they're both back. So, I mean, is it? I think maybe we, and this is a product of the Guardiola era. We all sort of like getting into the granular detail of how they're sort of breaking teams down, and the way he goes about it with little subtle changes all the time. And that's been amazing, sort of to watch. I mean, you know, speaking from my point of view professionally, I feel like Guardiola changed the way I try and watch, and you know, pretty moderately analyse football. And I think he's, you know, it's been amazing. But then maybe you miss the obvious of a guy who scores all the time and a guy who assists all the time just playing together and having an on-field thing where they've clicked from their first game together. It's just huge, really. And it can probably paper over things that aren't working as well in the team at the moment.
Yeah, and when you look at that relationship, Joe, for the Luton game especially, there was, Haaland said afterwards about, I think it was the third goal that he chipped over Krul. I'm getting them all mixed up now. Mm. But that one, he never once looked at where the ball was before it arrived at his feet. And he said so afterwards, he just knew that if he made that run, De Bruyne would play him in. And then to kind of combine that with the confidence, he'd missed a couple of those, he'd missed one where he'd gone through on Krul a bit earlier on. And then this time he got through, he was just like, okay, well, I'll just sit you down and chip it over you.
Yeah, I think it's that sort of difference in finishes, wasn't it, that we saw. Obviously, there were a couple that he just absolutely blasted at them, but that sort of chipped finish over Krul was just like that's confidence, isn't it? That's something that he's definitely sort of got back in the game with those first couple of goals. And on the relationship side of things as well, I think he just knows De Bruyne is just the perfect kind of player to have in the same team as Erling Haaland, because if someone makes a run ahead of him, De Bruyne is the kind of player who will see that run and know where it's ending up and kind of have an instinctive idea in his head of what that player is going to do or the movement they're going to make. And I think that's something that, even though we've seen a lot more, I think it's kind of what the main reason why he's missed that as well is because it's meant that De Bruyne's replacement has been Julian Alvarez. And obviously that's like a big topic of discussion at the moment amongst City fans, like, you know, Alvarez playing in central midfield and stuff like that. But I think it's just ultimately, Alvarez brings quite a lot when he's playing through the middle, but what he doesn't really bring is what Foden and De Bruyne do, which is that sort of, that creative forward-thinking sort of, I'm going to try and find the striker kind of, that kind of pass, because obviously Alvarez is one of the strikers, so he kind of doesn't really look for the same things. And having De Bruyne inside, who's literal first, usually his first thought when he has the ball is, how quickly can I get this to Erling Haaland? And that's having him in the side is obviously the easiest way to do it. And you know, when you're someone like Haaland who knows that De Bruyne can do that, then when you've got someone who's when you're playing against a team like Luton who weren't playing a particularly deep line, you have plenty of space to run into behind the centre backs. Like that's probably his dream setup, isn't it? To just have De Bruyne feeding through balls through to him like the whole night and being able to just have multiple opportunities to score.
Yeah, and you know what doesn't get said enough, Dom, in a really weird way, that is a real asset of having Haaland in the team. He's never offside. For a man who lives on that line, he never gets caught offside.
Yeah, and that's not by accident. He's excellent at that. Has he been caught offside once this season or something? Yeah. Preposterous? Yeah, and like, because there was the check on, I believe it was the second or third goal. They blur one of the first half ones. And so normally when you sort of, you know, it'll be checked. You kind of think, oh, where are we here? The fact it was a Haaland goal, I just thought, well, there's no way he'll be offside because he just isn't. Yeah. That's like for all the. It's funny with Haaland because, like, the conversation about his hold up play and what he brings, what he can do outside of the box and how that might have taken away from other stuff that he did, you know, as we've seen in recent weeks, not a great finish with his head, could probably be better with his right foot, but it's like, God, we make this guy sound shit who scores loads and loads of goals, don't we?
right donkey, isn't he? Yeah.
But there's clearly so much that he does to an unbelievable standard. I mean, like, his movement on the first goal, like, that's only a tap. Well, it's not a tapping, because, as you were saying, he smashed everything to net apart from his dink finish for the third. That's only a simple finish because of his movement that is so incredible. And he's so, always so tuned in on that side of it. And part of that movement is you can't catch him offside. And the thing is, I mean, I know, like, Mengi, who was marking him, who, you know, bless him, had a good old crack it on Tuesday, but that was, like, horrible. You couldn't really say he had a stinker, but say when Haaland's on, and that's what you got to deal with, you know, when you're playing a team like City who are looking through balls, like, catching a striker offside can give you a bit of respite, but he doesn't even give him that. And that then leads to scrambled bits of thinking on the next attack and the next attack. So it's like, yeah, it's a pretty special sixth sense he has, and it's not by accident.
I think a large part of it as well is just that he doesn't have to be offside. Like, when you're someone who's got the pace and strength that he's got, you can probably afford to give a defender a yard or two ahead of you and just know that you're absolutely not offside. Because if it comes to a foot race between Haaland and any centre back in the Premier League, with probably the exception of maybe prime Van Dijk, like, he's looking at pretty comfortably winning that battle 9 times out of 10. So I think he can absolutely afford to just give himself the extra sort of safety net to know that he's not offside. And if it comes to a through ball that he's being played through to him, if it's over more than like 5 or 10 yards, he'll probably back himself to just beat anybody in a foot race and sort of avoid the problem of isn't he offside.
Yeah, or even as we've seen with the goal against Brighton last year and the Everton goal this year with Jarrod Branthwaite, even if he's behind the centre-back, he'll just mow over them and carry on.
Run through, money.
That's a totally fair point Joe makes, but it's like, there are so many strikers who have loads of pace who get caught offside all the time, and you think, why are you doing that? I mean, going back to an era I think you're going to talk about later on, David, is Nicolas Anelka was offside an absurd amount for someone so strong and fast, I always thought. But he doesn't robot, isn't he?
Yeah. You've just reminded me as well, Dom, like the idea that his first goal was a tap-in, but he just, like, hit it so hard that he doesn't really know his own strength. Reminded me of a guy that I once worked with who was just this really big, strong guy who, again, didn't know his own strength, once just pulled the fridge door off in the kitchen.
I think there is an element of the size, there's like the particular dimensions of Kenilworth Road and the camera and all the rest of it, there's an element in some of those games where everything looks like it's been kicked a bit too hard. Like when they played Liverpool in a bit of a crazy game, they've had some mad games against the top teams there this year. Pretty much every shot Darwin Nunes had looked like the ground wasn't big enough for it, and there was no knowing where it was going to land. It's a pretty mad ground to watch football on the telly from, I think.
Yeah, I just had this image of Haaland walking back into the living room with the fridge door in his hand going, I've done it again.
Yeah, you can imagine that, can't you? Yeah. Well, he gets through a lot of milk, doesn't he? So, yeah, that's going to have to be a pretty robust fridge.
Yeah. The one thing I did notice, Dom, certainly it was more obvious against Luton because they were successful at it, but they were trying it a lot against Bournemouth as well, and it wasn't really sticking there. City are very happy to go direct to him at the moment as well. They're quite happy for a team to go man-to-man with them and go, Edison or Ortega, we'll just play it straight up to Haaland.
Yeah, Guardiola's gone full Barclays, hasn't he?
Yeah.
Nice. I think it's probably handy to see them doing it because I think, not to get too far ahead of ourselves, it's probably something that might come in handy at Anfield because you'd expect the Liverpool press to be very, very good that day. But how effective is it? It goes back to what we were saying about the hold-up play, and I think this is where De Bruyne is absolutely key because I think Haaland getting long, but getting a direct pass when De Bruyne is not in the team, it's like he'll try and bring the ball down, he'll try and bring someone else into play, and then have a look. Just De Bruyne's very presence means he's thinking, I'm laying it off there and I'm going. And like There are a couple of grandmasters who are like two moves ahead. So yeah, that sort of more direct approach with De Bruyne there, it's like, it really is much more effective.
Yeah. Let's talk injuries, Joe, because we've already been talking quite extensively about De Bruyne playing. He obviously got 90 minutes against Luton, and it kind of put everybody's mind at rest that when Guardiola said there were niggles in the hamstring, it's actually all right. There were just niggles and nothing else.
Yeah.
But equally, they've lost Grealish again. So, like, what are you feeling about all of that?
The Grealish thing was just, it was horrible, wasn't it? Obviously seeing Grealish just go off injured in the way they did at Copenhagen, it was just frustrating from our point of view, sort of like see how good it had been for 20 minutes and then just to see it, you know, through no fault of his own. Well, maybe it is fault of his own. Guardiola kind of intimated after the game, didn't he, that if you come on and you go off injured within 20 minutes, it's because you weren't ready. So I don't know who he was. I don't know if that was a swipe at his own physios and the fitness teams or if that was a swipe at Grealish himself. I don't know. But I think on this occasion, it was just impossible to watch it and not just feel really, really bad for him, because I think he looked broken when he came off. Like,
it was that image of him on the bench with the coat over his head. It was just like, oh, yeah, mate.
The coat over his head. There's another one that's sort of come out afterwards where he's just sort of sat on the bench with Foden next to him, sort of with his arm around him, and he's just staring into space, and he's just like, you can see that he's just his head. It feels like with Grealish this season, it's just as much like the sort of the mental struggles that he's having as well as the physical struggles. Obviously, like, the injuries probably haven't helped that, because I think he's had time out the team, and in that time out, Jeremy Doku very much became flavour of the month while he wasn't there, and everybody sort of started going, well, what does Jack Grealish give us compared to this guy, and blah, blah, blah. And that's probably, I think footballers find it difficult to completely block out that kind of noise. And for someone like Grealish, who talked in his first season about, you know, am I even having those sort of, having that identity crisis when he joined the club of, am I good enough to play for Manchester City? Sort of seeing half the fan base go, well, no, not really, when they see Jeremy Doku play football. Like, it probably, that has probably had some kind of impact on him. And then obviously repeated injuries, like coming back against Copenhagen, going off and then coming back to Luton and then going off again straight away. Obviously a bit earlier in the season, there was the whole thing with the breaking in at his home. I don't know. It feels like he's just having a really sort of mentally draining season for him, and that reaction on the bench against Luton was probably a bit of a culmination of all that. But I hope for his sake they kind of keep him out as much as we'd all want to see him back in as soon as possible, because of the nature of the running of games that we've got coming up soon. I think if they can give him an extra week or an extra week and a bit or 2 weeks, then do it, because I want to see him come back and see him, you know, be absolutely guaranteed to remain fit, or as close to guaranteed as you can be, rather than another situation where we get excited about having him back and then he goes off again very quickly. But yeah, I think it's just horrible to see it. I don't like seeing him go down at all. And obviously it looks like we're probably going to go into most of this horrific run in May without him, if not the whole March, without him, if not the whole of March.
Yeah.
Maybe he's so upset because at this stage he pretty much realises Guardiola's going to make him move in with Dr. Cougar in Barcelona. And if that ever happened, that'd be a good one for City TV to go and film, wouldn't it? Sort of Jack Grealish living with a preeminent surgeon in Barcelona. Good content.
There's a sitcom in there somewhere.
Yeah,
proper odd couple, be great.
Yeah, the mix-up when Grealish is having to perform surgery and then Kugat's named on the wing for City is it's ready to go, isn't it?
Ad-free episodes are available on Patreon. Sign up at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast.
Dom, let's talk about the other options in midfield, because Rodri was given a rest against Luton. Usually that's an issue for City. Do you know the last time, actually, that they won without Rodri in the team?
It wasn't this season, was it?
It was Huddersfield about 6 weeks ago. So, but apart from it was a long time ago. Yeah, yeah. But it just wasn't an issue at Luton. Normally it is. So why was that?
I think Kovacic is really good. And I think that's kind of gone under the radar a bit because he lost his mind at Arsenal. and he didn't play great at Wolves the week before. But generally, he's a really lovely, tidy footballer. And having him playing in there when you've got Stone sort of backing it up and carrying the ball in the midfield, and you've got Bernardo coming inside because Nunes is doing a bit of donkey work out on the wing. Yeah, I think that was important to, because like you say, obviously I've clearly already erased that Huddersfield FA Cup game from my brain. But, you know, Luton have been a team who've been effective against good sides this season. So I think that probably was important that against decent opposition, they showed they can play really well without Rodri there. Because you think back to last season, like the derby, the corresponding victory from this weekend's one, the 6-3, Rodri pulled up in the warm-up there, didn't he? And that was a case of, all right, just chuck Gundy and back in holding midfield and off you go. Can you imagine Rodri pulled up in the warm-up for a big game this season? Like, everyone would lose their mind. So, yeah, I think Kovacic played really well there. I really like him. I mean, obviously, he has fitness issues, but he came with them. And that's kind of just something City have got to wear. And you're probably not going to get a guy of that quality at his age for the cheap price they did if it wasn't for the fact that there's a bit of a flaw in there. But yeah, it probably shouldn't have taken this long for them to look so normal without Rodri there. And yeah, I think a lot of credit goes to Kovacic there.
Yeah, there's the other player there that Dom mentioned, Joe, in Matias Nunes, who I think's had a really strange week, because I can't decide if he's played well in these two games. And like, it's one of them where like you look at what he contributed and you're like, well, okay, he's been really good for the structure. He kept the ball really well. He carried it quite tidily. And then at the same time, you're like, well, he could have done this better, could have done that better. So it's been a really odd week for him.
Yeah, I've been quite happy with Nunes really on the whole this season, to be honest. And I think the last couple of games haven't really given me any sort of cause for concern. I think it's just, we all kind of, the problem with these kind of players, particularly in the roles that Kovacic and Nunes play, obviously Kovacic is a lot more seasoned and a lot more like set, like he's done a lot more games at the highest level of football, so he's obviously eased into his role in the team quite a lot quicker. But if you think about where Nunes has been before this, he started his career relatively late in terms of playing first team football for a club in Sporting Lisbon, and then has obviously then come to Wolves, where he's, I don't think at Wolves he's probably had the best coaching that he could have really got, like over the last year or so. So I think, yeah, he's obviously learning the job as he's going, and pretty much every signing that Pep Guardiola makes takes a year or so to really like get to the level that we signed them for, because they always have to sort of go through that phase of, you know, sitting on the bench and watching the games play out, sort of learning through watching and then playing the odd game here and there and then going into it. And I think Pep also likes to, as we've seen with Nunes, put people in a lot of different positions on the pitch so they get a bit more of an appreciation of what, so say Nunes playing on the wing, for example, like obviously his primary position you would hope in future is going to be playing in the eight. So he's going to have a bit more of appreciation of what the wingers are looking to do or the moves they're looking to make and playing out there. I think he did it with Foden, didn't he, at left back at one point, sort of giving him that idea of, so you get more of an appreciation of what everyone's job on the pitch actually is. And he's been given that kind of education, for lack of a better word. And hopefully that'll stand him in pretty good stead for next year. Because I do think Nunes is a lot of people seem pretty kind of meh on him. Like he's fine, but he's not doing anything particularly exciting. And that's probably fair, but you know, it's his first season at the club and it's going to be that way. Obviously, it's just as well that Kovacic has settled in a lot more quickly than him. But for Nunes, I'm given his age and sort of the number of top level games he actually has played, which despite being in his mid 20s, isn't really that many. I'm quite happy with how he's coming on.
Yeah, and then of course you've got, as Dom said, Stones kind of stepping in there and helping out. He's had an incredible couple of games, because it was him getting to the byline on both sides against Bournemouth that got City in behind in the first half. And then when the Luton game came around, they just kind of went, oh, well, sod it. We'll just have Stones running straight through the middle this time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think Stones is... That's what kind of frustrated me about the Chelsea game a couple of weeks ago. We always see whenever Stones plays just how, I think Akanji coming into centre mid in his place is fine. He comes in, he does a decent job. Like he'll come, it's not like putting Ruben Diaz running into the middle of midfield whereas he won't do that same kind of stuff.
Imagine.
Oh God, yeah, him just slide tackling everyone in the edge of the opposition penalty area.
Do it for the grass.
Yeah, whereas Stones, like, yeah, Stones has just got that midfield assurance. It's like it's strange how it's not normal how good he is at being a central midfielder despite being a centre back. And structurally is just so important for what the team want to do, that to see him miss out on a big game like Chelsea in favour of the Copenhagen game before it, where you probably could have got away with putting Akanji in the mid in that role, was really frustrating. So yeah, seeing him have that game against Luton, and you know, it kind of showed that that's what we're missing. You know, hopefully he can make it to the United game as well, because I think we've seen that when he does start, it's kind of like in and out, and he's been not being able to play too many games on the spin. So I'm hoping that he'll be actually back in for the United game rather than having, you know, the Bournemouth game and this Luton game having sort of ruled him out of that. But yeah, he's just so structurally, we've known this all season, but it's why sort of the fact that he's not as a mainstay at this part of the season is a bit of an issue with us going into the sort of run of the season we're going to. But hopefully this next month is where he cements himself as that mainstay.
Yeah. Dom, it's ultimately about getting players like Stones, like Bernardo, into those kind of positions in the centre of midfield, the tight spaces, and you want the players who are good on the ball in tight spaces there, don't you, to kind of just control what City have struggled to control this season.
Yeah, and I think, so as Joe says, like, Akanji isn't a disaster in there. I think the reason he gets to do the job is he's positionally really sound, and he knows where he should be, where, you know, in terms of the movements, in terms of where he should be out of possession, all the rest of it. But when he gets the ball and he's got to play 360 degrees, you can see the cogs turning a bit. Stones is just ridiculously smooth in there.
Stones is just ridiculously smooth anywhere, mate.
Yeah,
look,
yeah.
Look at him.
Yeah.
Rolls Royce of a man.
The smoothest man ever out of South Yorkshire, without a doubt. With, you know, honourable mention to Jarvis Cocker. but yeah, and to go back to the Nunes thing, you know, that is, for all the, my main thing was I was surprised that Guardiola didn't roll out Nunes on the left wing for the first time at Anfield, you know, just for team sheet banter. But
I've just remembered the Gundogan experiment from, what was it, 2017, 2018?
2018, oh yeah, that was good. That was a good night out. But Nunes playing that, you know, when Nunes played wide at Bournemouth, it facilitated Foden being inside. And when he did it at Luton, it meant that Bernardo could tuck in. Now, particularly with Grealish being out, City are probably in a situation where Foden and Bernardo are the two best in-form wide attackers. But they're also the two guys you don't want too far away from the middle, particularly without, you know, in the post-Gundian era. So yeah, I think it's kind of a bit of a Guardiola fundamental, isn't it? To get as many of the good players in the middle as possible. There was an extreme version of that in that away game at Brentford, which is one of the best performances of the calendar year. So yeah, more of the same, I think, in that regard, definitely.
Yeah, and just finally for the first part, Dom, I just want to give a shout out to the two goalkeepers this week, because Edison with a big save on about 80 minutes from a Bournemouth corner, and Ortega with his footwork has been immaculate anyway. He gave one away in that Luton game, but you know, occasionally you make a mistake like that. Ultimately, his footwork was fantastic, and then he pulls off a fantastic save in the second half, a double save that is two very different types of save.
Yeah, I mean, your educated eye would know better than me, but in terms of like pure goalkeeping, shot stopping, like the goalkeeping stuff, Ortega's better than Edison, isn't he?
I do think so.
Yeah. And obviously, unfortunately for Ortega, he's fantastic with the ball at his feet as well. But, you know, if we're talking about Haaland being a robot and a freak, there's one right at the other end of the team as well, because Edison's just different level. And, you know, I think 30, 40 years from now, I think that might still remain the case. He's obscene. But yeah, they have stepped up with big saves. I think overall there's been, and maybe this has been necessitated by those sort of stodgy performances we referred to earlier, but a lot more of like the mucky, grubby defending has started being done. I mean, I know that against Everton, that was the first time the Champions League final back four had all started together, but they all played in the wrong position. Against Brentford, that was the back four, and I don't think they get out of the Brentford game without those guys in there. You know, Akanji and Aki, I think, are always a little bit underrated. And yeah, there was a big sort of fuss about the lack of clean sheets, but
it's weird because the defending's kind of got worse, but now the clean sheets have started.
Going to say: are they defending better because they've got clean sheets, but the goalies aren't doing a lot of work, or when it was like the old they were doing the old Claudio Bravo formula of one shot on target, one goal conceded. But yeah, I don't know. I think all of those defenders being back and playing together, Stone's been back, the goalie's looking on form. Because the thing is, you can... That surely helps the defence when you see Ortega and Edison, you know, sort of shelling peas behind them. That's a confidence thing. And yeah, it does feel like it's been a good week for the whole defensive unit, really, like in terms of they've all got to do important work, whereas City can sometimes go through a week of games where it's kind of crushed velvet slippers and smoking jackets for the back four, but that's not been the case lately.
Yeah, well, we'll find out if that's going to be the case on Sunday. It will be the 21st Manchester Derby played at the Etihad in the Premier League and the 24th there in all competitions. When City moved to Eastlands in 2003, nobody would have expected their record against United to be as good as it is. But given City's dominance in the league table in the last decade or more, you might be surprised that the record isn't quite as good as you think it should be. Still with me? Not sure. In the league, both have won 9, drawn 2 and lost 9 at the Etihad. And including cup games, United have a slight advantage. And as it's nearly 20 years since the first meeting between these sides at this stadium, Sam Rosbottom has dipped into our archives to hear from the scorers from that day.
It's safe to say March 2004 was a completely different time. The Simpsons was still on BBC Two in the UK. Jose Mourinho and Rafa Benitez were yet to manage in England. The Nokia 2600 dominated the mobile phone market. The Lord of the Rings, The Return of the King, was still on at the cinema. And the Cha-Cha Slide by DJ Casper was the UK number one. Oh, and City were struggling in the Premier League. The first season at the new City of Manchester Stadium had been underwhelming. An early exit from the UEFA Cup set things off to a bad start before the team went on a run of no wins in 14 Premier League games. When United came to town, City were 3 points above the relegation zone. Nobody really expected what happened next.
I remember all of it. I remember the build-up to it. I remember obviously being the first game. Everyone was excited and it was a big deal at the time. And obviously we managed to give me the nod that I was playing. I sorted the tickets out for the family, so to speak. And then, once again, luckily enough, got the second goal. I suppose I'd like to think the important goal that won the game. But we won 4-1, didn't we? So it was a fantastic performance. It was a real good performance. That's
former City striker John Macken. He'd been in and out of the team all season, but he started this one. After Robbie Fowler opened the scoring, he hooked in City's second.
You go in with belief. You know, it's your first game. You know it's a derby. Derbies are always going to be exciting, kind of like a cup game, really, you know, because it's you want to go and you want to do well and you know, you want to get one over on your rivals. And that's what we did. And, you know, fortunately, we was a better side on the day, you know, all over the pitch. And, you know, the scoreline reflects that, I suppose.
It was a special goal for him because he was scoring against the club where he started his career.
It's always nice, you know, you don't tend to... play well, you know, when you play your own teams, you want to go and you want to, you know, put in a good performance because you want to show them what, you know, they're missing, so to speak, or not missing, but what, you know, what you could have done for them. So, and when you get your goal and, you know, you enjoy it in your own little way.
Shortly after Macken made it 2-0, Paul Scholes pulled a goal back for United. That made it a bit of a tense end to the first half, and Kevin Keegan made changes at the break to try and take control of the game. One of his subs, Trevor Sinclair, added City's third.
It was a dream come true, that. I have to say, it was an ambition that I'd had from a kid. And, you know, Manchester United were very successful when I was growing up and for a majority of my career. And, I'd always dreamed about scoring a goal against them, and especially in the light blue of Man City. So, yeah, to envisage that and to realise that, it was an amazing feeling.
He explains how the goal was a bit of a relief.
I wasn't having a great time at City at the time. My form wasn't good and I was struggling to get into the side, and the team were playing quite well, and it was all a bit of a struggle. And I remember Steve McManaman and Claudio Reyna come off as subs at half-time, and Kevin went, "You're coming on." And I just remember going to the toilet. I'm not really a religious person, but I went to the toilet and I prayed, just give me 45 minutes of a good performance, and obviously went back out there. I think they got a goal back to make it 2-1, and then I scored to make it 3-1 and open that two goal cushion up. So yeah, I was delighted to score that. First and only time I've ever took my shirt off celebrating a goal, and I think it just showed the emotion that was involved. And it was a big moment for me, probably one of the most passionate I felt after scoring a goal, and the most emotional.
He, like Macken, was extra motivated for the Manchester derby because he grew up a City fan.
It was a game that you didn't really have to get me up for. It was always, listen, you know, as a Manc, you always want to do well against your rivals. You see it against clubs where you've been released or where they've, you know, let you go or whatever, and you think you want to prove something. Man United was always that for me, and I seem to always raise my game against them.
The icing on the cake for that win came in stoppage time. Sean Wright Phillips added a spectacular fourth for City after chasing a clearance down the right flank.
Oh, well, to be honest, I actually thought the ball was going to roll out. So, like, I was kind of jogging at first, and then when I realised it was going to stay in, I just thought, let me just go on a run here and maybe we can get something from here. But when I got to the box, there was nobody really in there. So I thought, if I get half a yard and get a nice connection, possibly I could cause a problem, but it happened to fly in the top corner.
That goal came with an iconic celebration, a robot dance. Wright Phillips explains why he did it.
Well, I was with my cousin at a family event, and there were some people doing some strange dances in there, and one of the family members was doing that dance. So I said to him, when I score my next goal, I said to him, I'll do that for you. And he said, yeah, right, whatever. So I thought, at first I wasn't actually going to do it, but I thought I promised him, so I just got out. I felt pretty embarrassed after it, though.
That completed a 4-1 City win in the first ever Manchester derby at Eastlands. They would finish the season with 41 points, an 8-point clear of the bottom three in 16th place. There weren't many things to shout about in that 2003-04 season, but that victory over United certainly stands out as one of the highlights.
Hi, I'm John Macken, and you're listening to the Blue Moon Podcast.
If you enjoy the show, please give it a rating and a review wherever you get your podcasts.
That was Sam Rosbottom looking back on that first Manchester derby at the Etihad, the City Manchester Stadium as it was then. Joe, this sort of illustrates how the tables have turned, because everything that we were hoping for going into that derby in 2004 is kind of like what I'm hearing from United now. I've been speaking to colleagues and friends who are United fans, and all I keep hearing is, I just hope we don't get battered. And it just took me back to that sort of like that first one at the City of Manchester Stadium, the last one at Main Road, thinking, oh, just win it for the occasion. Please, God, do something. Like, don't humiliate yourselves now.
Yeah, it almost felt like a bit of a cup final back then, didn't it? It was like, it was the one fixture that everyone would sort of look forward to as like, not look forward to, because it was rarely looking forward to it, but it was the one fixture where you'd sort of be like, if there's anything that we can get from this season that will like, that will feel good, that will fit, that will be like a big win, that's it. And that's kind of, obviously United aren't quite at that level yet in terms of where they are in the Premier League table, but
yeah, on the shitness scale.
The shitness scale, they're on the way there, they're getting down there, but they're kind of at the point where, like, say, like we were, it's just don't get battered. Like, my United supporting mates who I've been speaking to have been saying exactly the same thing, that they're fully expecting to concede at least three or four goals on Sunday, and it's kind of like, we just want to sort of keep it to a respectable scoreline. And I think that's kind of, like I say, it's even though the places in the table haven't sort of, the disparity of that isn't quite as big as it was back in 2003 when we were playing against them. Like, it's still, they're still feeling that same gulf between the two teams, and that's, it is very strange. If you'd have told any City fan back then that that's where we'll be in 20 years' time, I think you'd have a lot of people just questioning your sanity, basically.
Yeah, I think we should say, Dom, as well, that while United are shit at the moment, they're not as shit now as City were then. So, like, it was a big scalp for City back then.
Oh yeah, massively. Without a doubt. I mean, so like that season, the only thing you had to write home about City really was, and I know you covered this on the pod recently, the comeback for the ages at Tottenham. Of course, that set up a fifth round trip to Old Trafford where City lost to 10 men. So,
as you do.
Yeah. So it kind of, the only thing that City had to crow about that season, United had ruined anyway. And yeah, it's like a couple of things that sort of spring to mind of like a sign of the times and then and now is So I remember I was in upper sixth at Cardinal Langley then. And I remember hearing a teacher and one, because it had been in North Manchester, it's like, it was quite red. One of the teachers and one of the other sixth form was like talking about, you know, are we going to beat him again? Like, you know, as United fans. And one said, oh, we're going to do the treble over him because it would have been three wins. It's like, the treble. I'm like, God, these lot just go on about trebles all the time. Can you imagine?
And now, yeah.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. So I was thinking, well, sod that. But then firmly expecting to happen. And the other thing I remember was, and this might be something that you think about in a commentary feature as well, like think bits of television coverage that stick in your mind because you've watched the video back a lot. On, I think it was like Sky's highlights, some highlights, probably Sky's. There was a bit like the recording of this game I had. They did a bit where they were vox popping the fans beforehand. And there was a fella who started off saying, no disrespect to City. But, which, no disrespect always prefaces something stunning.
Really disrespectful.
This was
yeah.
No disrespect to City, but I think United win 6-0, Van Nistelrooy double hat trick. Now, nowadays, there's one team that scores 6 goals in derbies, and there is a striker who literally gets very close to double hat tricks. So, yeah, it's a. Say, as Joel says, the disparity in the table isn't what it was, but it's a mad one. And, yeah, City were nowhere near them at that time. On the game itself, it was only really Trevor Sinclair's goal where you thought, oh, hang on, actually.
Yeah.
This might be done now because, yes, City was so flimsy under Keegan that year. And basically, you know, Bintoon Luck was like great crack. But then as soon as Scholes scored, you think, all right, here we go then.
Yeah. And there's been plenty of derbies where City have had a 2-0 lead.
Yeah, yeah. But, oh, well, maybe the mistake Scholes made there was scoring in the first half because.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
2-0 is not a dangerous scoreline. That's nonsense. Unless it's City at home in a Manchester derby where it is perilous.
Yeah, yeah. So I better hope it's either 1 or 3 on Sunday. let's preview that game shortly. But before we do...
Oh,
It's a quiz on 20 years of Manchester derbies at the Etihad.
There we go.
See, this didn't make the notes.
It didn't. No, I conspicuously kept the questions away from you because I thought if you have the answers, you might do a little bit better than normal.
Yeah, make it easy, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Joe, you've not done a quiz for a while, so I'm going to let you have the choice. Would you like to go first or second?
I'll go first. Why not?
Excellent. Okay, pick a number 1 to 6.
We'll go Vincent Kompany, number 4.
Number 4, okay. Who missed a penalty against United in May 2007, blowing the chance to score City's first home goal in 5 months?
Oh my God, 2007. I'm just going to have to pick a name here. Craig Bellamy.
It wasn't. Dom, do you remember?
Darius Vassell.
It was indeed. No confidence whatsoever. Smacked it straight at Edwin van der Sar. There we are. So, swing and a miss.
He took it with the confidence of a man who less than a year earlier had missed a vital penalty for England. Oh, no, it was Euro 2004, a few years earlier. But, yeah, it'd not got any better at them.
Yeah. So, no points there. Dom, over to you.
5, please.
Question number 5. Okay, who was the first City goalkeeper to keep a clean sheet against United at the Etihad?
Oh, that's a good one. Joe Hart?
No. It was Kasper Schmeichel.
Oh, yeah, 1-0, the Giovanni one. Yeah,
it was
indeed,
yeah. Okay, so 0-0 still.
Clean sheets all round,
yeah. Yeah, clean sheets all round. Joe, over to you.
I'll go number 1.
Number 1, okay. How many different Manchester United managers have lost at the Etihad?
Oh, God. So Fergie has. Moyes almost certainly did. Mourinho did. Van Gaal did. I'm gonna say 5.
It's close, but there's one missing. Can you name who it is, Dom?
It's Solskjaer and Ten Hag. They all have, haven't they?
They haven't. No, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer has never lost at. Never.
Yeah,
lost
that's what I was thinking. I was thinking Fergie 1, Moyes 2, Mourinho 3. Ten Hag 4, and Van Gaal 5.
Yeah, and Ralf Rangnick as well.
Oh, of course.
There you go. Okay, so still 0-0. Dom, over to you. 2, 3, and 6 available.
6, please.
Number 6. Okay, which City player has scored with a shot from the furthest distance out against United at the Etihad?
Oh, right. Is it Giovanni?
I will accept Giovanni, and the reason why I'll accept Giovanni is because it's either him or Alexander Kolarov, because on the still images, it looks like they're both about the same distance out.
Kolarov's on the wing, though, isn't it?
Yeah. I'm minded to say Kolarov scored from the greatest distance, but I can't exactly prove it, so I will accept Giovanni as well.
Giovanni would have been my guess as well.
good rigor with the accurate answer there.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, so 1-0 over to you, Joe, for the final choice. What do you like, number two or number three?
I'll go number two.
Number two. Who is the only City player ever to be sent off in a Manchester derby at the Etihad?
Kompany.
It is Vincent Kompany. 1-1. Okay, Dom, you can win it here. Question number three. Who is the only City manager in the last 20 years that never beat United at the Etihad?
Oh, right, okay. Oh, Mark Hughes.
It is Mark Hughes. Yeah, there we go. Okay, Dom just about squeaks it 2-1. Congratulations all round. I did have a tiebreak question ready, which, I mean, I always say this because ever since I've started writing tiebreaks, we've never needed one. So I'm going to give it you anyway. How many different players have represented City in a Manchester derby at the Etihad? Closest wins. So, Dom, you won, so you have a stab.
Oh, God, I mean, don't know. 180.
And Joe?
I'll go 181.
Wrong way, I'm afraid. 114. Oh, not that many. Yeah, not that many.
Because that doesn't take into account that City have been pretty stable for the last sort of decade.
Yeah,
yeah.
Because I seem to remember sort of like around the time City first moved to the Etihad, it was like United had about 12 lads who'd played derbies, and City had about 50 because they're just like always changing, and they were stable and won everything. Again, how times change.
How times change, indeed. There we go.
You see stats pop up all the time about clubs and players, and you want to know that exact thing about City. There's an answer. Statcity.co.uk. Want to find out all of the players who played alongside club legends like David Silva, Sergio Aguero or Vincent Kompany? Or maybe you'd like to know which team found it hardest to score past Joe Hart. You can find out City's record in every competition, at every stadium, and under every manager. Just go to statcity.co.uk and browse away. That's statcity.co.uk.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast, and we're very sorry about that.
So then, let's actually talk about the games coming up then. Joe, does it matter what United do this weekend? And the reason why I ask that is because I'm not sure they can do much else other than sit deep and try and hit City on the break and take the chances. Whereas for City, it feels like it's either the City team that turned up against Bournemouth or the City team that turned up against Luton.
Yeah, I kind of feel the same way. I think it's with United, like I mentioned before, with the number of shots that they're conceding at the moment, I think there's some like they concede 23 shots against Fulham. They've conceded like high teens, if not low 20s against, you know, Luton, Sheffield, Burnley, like all these teams that a team that's got the aspirations that United do should really be keeping at arm's length and not necessarily struggling with defensively, but they just seem to be incapable of keeping. They're getting clean sheets on some occasions, but they're certainly not playing well defensively. So even if they do sit back, which I think is pretty much the only way that they can go, like Ten Hag doesn't have the experience of getting them set up to do that. Like Ten Hag's sort of way of playing football is very, I think towards the beginning of last season, he was getting a lot of praise for being a bit more pragmatic about things. But as the time's gone on since then, we've kind of seen that he's really sort of rigid in how he gets United playing. He doesn't really have much of a plan B outside of his usual. And I think with the loss of Højlund from that front three, you know, they're going to be looking at playing Rashford up front, Anthony on the wing, and then Garnacho on the wing as well, which is a front three that looks a lot less scary than Garnacho, Rashford on the left, and Højlund up front. So even their counter attacking, they'll obviously have Garnacho for pace and Rashford for pace as well up front, but it's not the most clinical front line that you could be looking at going the other way in terms of counter-attacking. So I think United will probably United will probably try to just push us and maybe sort of try to hopefully go for that. I say hopefully because it means we can probably exploit it, but they'll hopefully try and sort of match us and see what they can do. But I think if they sit deep, I think with their current defensive problems, they're still going to be having big issues because their injury list doesn't look too kind to them, and the form that some of the defense and midfield are in at the moment is not great. So I think it all comes down to us. If we show up at our game controlling best and sort of create a lot, you know, and Haaland has got his shooting boots back on, then we could be looking at another pretty offensive scoreline for United, to be honest. But I think otherwise we can be in a position where maybe it's 0-0 at half time and we're all looking at each other thinking this is a bit ropey here, but with any luck we'll have a couple of goals early on.
Yeah, Dom, the problem, I guess, comes from City is that one of the big issues they've had this season is controlling teams when the transitions are happening. And if United are trying to do that, when you've got players like... I mean, Garnacho is the one that I think possibly scares me the most, given that he has caused City problems on the transition in the past when City could control them. This season, they're less effective at that. And you kind of look at what United might try and do there.
Yeah, I think Garnacho have been particularly dangerous when, and United in general, because they... It's a funny thing with judging United's form, because every Manchester United defeat is like a big sort of comic event. I mean, the Fulham one, it's like finding new ways to lose in an amusing fashion. But they were unbeaten in 2024 before that. As Joe alluded to, there's a big injury list. And I think Hoyland is a big miss there, because I think part of, so having seen a bit of them on their unbeaten run, having a settled front four of Hoyland as like an actual focal point, with Garnacho and Rashford on the wings and Fernandez having people to hit in front of him with through balls, just worked really well. While like guys like Garnacho and Fernandez and Rashford sort of still carry an individual threat on the break, I think it's less concerning from a City point of view, because I'm not sure how it functions as a unit, because, you know, Rashford's going to have to play at centre forward where he isn't as natural. So that takes away his threat from out wide, and also means they've got a less effective centre forward, certainly less effective in all like the build-up stuff and knitting things together than Hoyland was. So, yeah, I think, and don't get me wrong, derbies can hinge on these sort of things, but I think United are kind of, at the moment, because of their injuries, are kind of left with wanting a moment of magic from one of those forward players I mentioned in terms of like an actual game plan to take City apart. It doesn't feel like they're as well tooled up to do that on the break as, like, say, the United Solskjaer teams were. And whether that's down to injuries or whether that's not a great comment on Erik ten Hag, that actually Solskjaer's United look better equipped to get results in these games than his does right now.
Yeah. For you, Dom, Stones into midfield for that extra body, or the wingers coming in and the fullbacks pushing wide? Because either way, it doesn't really feel like United will do anything different than try and counter-attack. So I'm just kind of wonder if you need to do the Stones thing if you've got the fullbacks holding the wide positions.
Obviously, that's assuming Gvardiol's fit. I think Stones into midfield, just on the very, very basic point that
he's been playing really well recently, yeah.
Yeah, all of City's best performances over the last year have come with doing that. And as we just discussed, like, he can do it in different ways. The way he did it at Bournemouth was totally different to the way he did it at Luton. So yeah, definitely do that. It makes a lot of the people around him play better. I am not as opposed to the fullbacks pushing on as some people are, and I think it worked really well at Brentford, but I think that is particularly something to do against teams who are playing a back five, which, due to a lack of available defenders, I don't think United will do.
Yeah. With Grealish out, Joe, and we talked about the options on the wing earlier on, can Guardiola afford to just kind of chuck Doku in there as a bit of a live wire? Or, again, are you kind of looking for that Nunes thing for the structure? I don't know.
No, I personally don't think you can put Doku in the side for this. I have pretty strong feelings on Doku in big games this season, and the fact that we failed to win a single one that he started is a pretty damning statistic on that side of things. I think I'd much rather see a front three that's more similar to the Bournemouth game, where it's Foden on the left and what looked like it was going to be Foden on the left and Bernardo on the right. And I'd rather see that with De Bruyne, Kovacic and Rodri than than anything else. Like, I think we just need to go for our players that are most set up to control the game and just to sort of keep, basically make sure that we keep possession. And because if they, ultimately United's, whether or not we think that there's much threat going there or not, United's realistically best chance of getting us is going to be on the transition and is going to be winning the ball in their own half, quickly releasing it up the other end of the pitch and just seeing what they can do. And I just think having a player like Doku, who as much as he's good at terrorising the defence and would probably give whoever United decides to put out a right back a pretty horrid game, I think that ultimately what he does is still very high risk in a way that is it means that you end up turning the ball over quite a lot, which if you're playing against a team that is going to pretty much depend on that counter-attacking threat with a lot of pace going the other way, because Garnacho and Rashford are not slow players, then I think having Doku in the side is just more of a, even against a team that we might not particularly rate in United at the moment, I think it's just too much of a risk. The possible negatives for me outweigh what he does bring, and what he does bring at the moment, in based on his recent performances, is not a great deal. Like his goal and assist numbers outside that Bournemouth game are not great. So I think for me, I would rather put Foden out there. And have him and Bernardo sort of controlling things on either wing. And if he wants to put Alvarez and De Bruyne in the middle and put Haaland up front, that's not what I would do. As I've said, I would put De Bruyne up front with Kovacic and Rodri around him, because I think that setup of Kovacic and Rodri just works really well in these kind of games.
Yeah, I was going to ask Dom, after he was sensationally dropped from a Premier League starting 11 for Bournemouth, is there room for Alvarez in there?
I mean, he's maybe the one that I expect to play, because whenever there's a vacancy there, you know, if any of the attacking midfielders are out, he tends to get in. Guardiola loves him. He certainly, the intensity he'd provide with his pressing could give that United defence kittens, and he'll be well tuned in for a derby atmosphere. But I agree with Joe, I'd like to see Kovacic play. Yeah. I think just from the point of view that I just had a quick look through, Haaland hasn't started a Premier League game with both Kovacic and De Bruyne. And it'd be kind of nice to see how that shakes out, because with Kovacic there, you get the extra element of control that he can bring in sort of his play deeper. But as you said, he really looks for Haaland. Like, it's noticeable how much he does. And obviously, we don't need to say any more about De Bruyne and Haaland's link-up. So put those two in there together, then it could be a pretty fruitful day for Haaland.
Yeah. A quick word on Copenhagen as well, Joe. I don't think it really matters whether City had scored late on in that one, because I think 3-1 or 2-1 doesn't really change how Guardiola will view it, because he'll still be kind of nervous about how it could go wrong. So I'm kind of wondering how you think the week shapes up with United, then Copenhagen, and then Liverpool, given that Guardiola's likely to want his best team out for all three.
I think if there is going to be one where we will see some rotation, it'll be Copenhagen. But I think obviously the level of rotation with just a 1 or 2 goal lead, like I'm with you, I think 3-1 is better, but it's still not, you know, it's not let's put our feet up and put the kids out for the second leg kind of scoreline. I think we'll see a couple of players maybe rotate in that we might not have seen if it had only been 2-1. But I still think ultimately the bulk and the spine of that squad will be pretty much the same. We'll still see Haaland play. De Bruyne, I'm not 100%, because I think if you're gonna sort of say that he played 90 minutes against Luton as well, I think putting him for 4 starts in a row with sort of the intensity that will inevitably be there with both United and Liverpool, is Copenhagen is probably one that he can sit out. But I think Rodri as well is going to start all of them. Diaz, Ake probably, maybe Walker will start at least 2 of them. I think it's just, you're looking at the bulk of our best 11 start in that Copenhagen game, but it does allow us some ability to maybe rotate out a couple of them here and there. Maybe if Guardiola's close to being fit, maybe he does come in for that Copenhagen game. I'm not sure. But it also means that if we get 1 or 2 goals on early in the game, that means it gets to a point where we can just start subbing people off and getting them rested for Liverpool. I think if it was 2-1 and we go in at halftime 1-0 up and the score is 3-1 on aggregate, then we probably stick with a lot of that team and just keep going. Whereas I think if we go in at halftime 1-0 up against Copenhagen with it being 4-1 on aggregate, then I think that's the point where we can probably start bringing off, you know, De Bruyne, we can start bringing off like Foden, Bernardo, whichever of the big ones start. I think we can start to think about bringing them off and giving them a bit more of a rest before Liverpool. But realistically, with Liverpool, they're probably looking more, they're probably a bit more concerned about the fact they're going to, they're going away to Prague on the Thursday than us playing at home to Copenhagen. So I think we should still be in a better shape than Liverpool, no matter what we do on Wednesday, really.
Yeah, and still somehow lose it. I don't know how that happens. Dom, there's room for this as well, because City have managed minutes quite well when you look back at this week, because Rodri got the whole game off against Luton. De Bruyne has been out for a few games before that game and then got 90 minutes to kind of help with his rhythm. I'm wondering if there is any need to change things that much. If this is actually, when you zoom out and look at the fixture list, you know, even further than just the three games this week, you go, actually, Guardiola's done quite well at managing minutes all the last month or so.
Yeah, and it helps. I mean, I know we talked about Grealish quite a bit, but everyone's kind of fit now. And it's that thing with City's squad that it can go, because of the size of it, it can go from looking like, if there are three injuries, it looks tiny. If there's one injury or everyone's fit, it's like, oh, there's options everywhere because it's talented players, it's guys who can play in a number of different roles. Yeah, Copenhagen feels like probably like about a four changes game for me. Like, yeah, say Alvarez in for De Bruyne. If we're assuming Doku doesn't start the derby, he probably starts that one. There was all those Champions League group games, the away group games where it was strong teams, but like Nunes and Rico Lewis started within them. That sort of thing, I reckon.
Yeah, not quite Sergio Gomez level though. That's the thing. Yeah,
Obviously, if you're going to have a left back bombing on down the outside playing on the wing, Sergio Gomez is your perfect man, isn't he? It really is a mystery.
maybe he's just not as good as anybody else. That's the that's the mystery solved.
Or it's not a mystery at all. Yeah, there you go.
Yeah. Let's get some predictions. We didn't have any winners on last week's charity bet. So we're still on £885 for the season so far. We're raising money for the Man City Fans Food Bank Support Group. They're collecting for Manchester Central Food Bank, and they'll be back outside the Etihad ahead of the derby. They'll be under the bridge near Asda until about 3 o'clock. So please drop them a donation if you can. William Hill is giving us three £10 correct score singles to try and add some money into the kitty for them as well. We're going to start with the derby, which you two have lost your absolute minds on this one. I've gone for a 3-1 City win because that's about as comfortable as I can get in this sort of situation, which is 9-1 and £90. Joe, tell us what you've done and why.
I've gone slightly more optimistic for a 4-1. I just think Haaland having his shooting boots back. I'm confident. I'm not going to say Haaland hat trick, but I think he'll score a brace maybe. Slightly more optimistic than yourself.
Yeah, 14-1 and £140. Dom, entertain us.
absolute hubris going on here. This is being recorded. So predicting derbies is a mug's game. It always has been. So
just ask that fan on the 2004 coverage. Yeah, yeah.
Precisely, yeah. Look at me making fun of him earlier. So I thought, slightly inspired by our good friend Casey, who predicts 6-1 on every single bet he ever has, I thought I'd pick an iconic Manchester Derby scoreline. I've gone for 5-1.
5-1 is 28-1 and £280 if you're right. I hope you are.
No disrespect to Manchester United.
Yeah.
As I say, that's not an entirely serious prediction. And when you tweet that out and tag me, it'll be entirely devoid of context. And I'm going to look a right knobhead. But
yeah,
here
there is that. There is that. Yeah. I mean, you've made a rod for your own back here. It's like you've made your bed, lie in it. So here we go.
Made a Rodri for my own back.
You have. Oh, and that's a terrible pun. And it's going to probably stay in the edit. So,
it's sounded borderline, didn't it?
Copenhagen then. Dom, what are you having?
I've come back down to planet Earth and said 2-0.
Yeah, welcome home. It's 6-1 and £60 if you're right. I've gone for a 2-1 City win. That's 10-1 and £100. Joe's still living somewhere in the outer reaches of the Milky Way, because what have you gone for?
I've gone 3-2. I think that this game reeks of being comfortably in the lead, taking off a few key players and complacency station, taking control, and we give up a one or two pretty stupid goals at the end of the game that ultimately don't matter, but will not mean a clean sheet.
Well, actually, I'd not even read it like that, but now you've said it like that, I can get behind that, and it's 33-1.
That's longer odds than 5-1 in the derby.
It is, 33-1, £330 if you're
that
right.
That is mad when you put it that way.
Yeah, so fingers crossed. Good luck, everyone. Remember, you've got to be 18 or over to gamble. Prices can change. And for more information about responsible gambling, take a look at begambleaware.org. Now then, over the weekend, Gary Neville got a bit of a reaction for his blue £1 billion bottle jobs line during the League Cup final. From a City point of view, I saw some mild annoyance online that City often get unfavourable mentions in the commentary. So this week, we've decided to reflect on some of the more iconic lines said during City's matches of the past. Iconic commentary often comes with iconic moments.
Balotelli! Aguero!
That's Martin Tyler in 2012, but we're not really focusing on the moments where commentators shout a player's name. We want lines like this.
I swear you'll never see anything like this ever again! So watch it! Drink it in!
And that takes us back to 2004 and another Martin Tyler commentary over a last-minute winner, but this time he's helped out by Andy Gray.
There's just a bit of tugging on Macken. He scored! Oh, John Macken! Tottenham Hotspur 3, Manchester City 4. They have made the impossible possible. Depleted, but delighted.
Well, I've seen it. But I still don't believe it.
That's an iconic line from the co-commentator. Here's another.
Vincent Kompany thought about hitting it the first time and he ignores it and he goes a bit further forward. Wow! Where do you want your statue, Vincent Kompany?
There's something about those one-liners that can stand out. Here's the late Gerald Sinstad commentating over an iconic Manchester Derby goal.
Lee. Pulled across for Law!
That was a decisive late goal. Here's one that put the icing on the cake in a Manchester derby. And step forward Alan Parry to nail the commentary.
Final charge, perhaps, by Manchester City, by Phillips. Oh, my word! Some final charge, wasn't it? Pick that one out! Good night!
I think it's the good night there that makes that one. Probably because you don't hear it too often. John Champion pulled that same trick with this Georgie Kincladze goal in 1996.
Kincladze will try and beat his man and suddenly space opens up. Still Kincladze, inside the penalty area, this will be a fantastic goal! Oh, that's mesmeric! It's sublime! And it's typically Georgie Kincladze.
How many times have you heard the word mesmeric in commentary since that goal? Here's a similar one from Hugh Johns in 1974.
Marsh. Olive. That's the way Dennis Law scores his goals.
The pacing on that line is good too, but we'll come back to that in a bit. First, here's more superlatives. Marvellous getting a run out here from Clive Tyldesley.
Early cross, chance at the far post, catch cut. That's just marvellous stuff. It's a dream day for Manchester City. And that, a goal as good as Jim Leighton has ever seen or been beaten by.
And he rounds that off with, where did Hinchcliffe come from? He's the left back, remember. But perhaps the better line from that commentary game comes after Ian Bishop's goal. It's just so simple.
Oh, Bishop! 3-0! Ian Bishop's first goal for Manchester City. May have won the derby for them. Already.
That one word, already, tells you so much about the game. Gerald Sinstad does the same thing here with a nice bit of repetition thrown in before it.
A touch of the real Rodneys. Oh, what a goal that was. He teased and he teased and he teased. And then he thrashed it. Bang!
Now back to the pacing. And sometimes the way the commentator interacts with the crowd helps as well. Rob Hawthorne's commentary over Mark Kennedy's goal at Blackburn in the year 2000, the one that pretty much sealed promotion, was perfect for that.
Dickhoff here looking to secure a win, and Kennedy probably has done!
That brief pause while you hear the crowd celebrate Kennedy's goal is just chef's kiss perfect. And as this favourite line for so many shows, it doesn't always need a goal for some good commentary. Step forward Guy Mowbray on Match of the Day from last year's Manchester Derby at the Etihad.
Alex Ferguson was asked in 2009 if City could ever go into a derby as favourites. He said, not in my lifetime. Now it's every time.
If it was ever in doubt, you could win the City fans over with a good bit of Berting, as that shows. But one of the most iconic lines of commentary in football history comes over a goal that was scored against City. Francis Lee returned to Main Road with Derby, and Barry Davis treated us to this.
Lee, interesting. Very interesting. Oh, look at his face. Just look at his face.
The way Davis's voice breaks there just suits the goal perfectly. With so many of these lines of commentary, you can see the goal in your mind's eye easily. Maybe because they go so well together, or maybe because you've just watched them over and over and over again. Either way, even though it doesn't always feel like it, City do also have their fair share of moments from the commentary box.
I'm Clyde Tilsley. Yeah, I know, balmy night, Barcelona, all that. Yeah, that Clyde Tilsley. You're listening to the Blue Moon Podcast. Enjoy.
This is the Blue Moon Podcast. Follow us on Twitter at Blue Moon Podcast.
That was a look at some iconic pieces of commentary. I'm going to have to come to you to kind of get your favourites, because there's goals that you watch that are great goals. There are goals then that you can just remember because of the commentary line. So, Joe, any for you from the past that stand out?
Yeah, so I've got one. I've got a couple, but the one that sort of first stood out to me is the one in the 2014 Champions League group stage v Bayern, where we basically brought it back from being 2-1 down against Pep Guardiola's side to win 3-2 with an Aguero hat trick. And on commentary for that game was, I can't remember who is alongside. It was probably Peter Drury, because it normally is, but it was Andy Townsend. And as the third goal went in, Andy Townsend like genuinely just shouts "get in" as it goes in, which I loved it. As honestly, it was the first time for that I can remember where I'd sort of felt like the commentators wanted City to win. Like, obviously Andy Townsend's, I've heard him be like quite sort of giddy about Chelsea wins and United wins in the past, but this was kind of the first time where I was like, oh, like, this guy actually wants City to win. Like, this is nice. This must be how other people feel. My other one is a bit cheeky. It's not really a single line of goal celebration, but it's Manchester City v Burnley in 2019, the infamous Ashley Barnes game where Liverpool fans were all changing the profile pictures to Barnes to will them onto a victory for title race. Aguero scored in the 63rd minute, and Carragher on co-commentary did not say a single word for the rest of the game. So that was quite nice.
Excellent. Dom, any stand out for you? I mean, the one we always talk about, Rob Hawthorn at Blackburn. So I'm praying you might have a mention for him.
I was simply like, so you had the Mark Kennedy bit on the trail there. The little bit after that where he just starts talking about everything that's happening, about Kennedy running to Joe Royal and Nicky Weaver's cartwheel show, and the celebrations now can start in earnest. Manchester City will be playing Premier League football next season. That, like,
I still cry at that bit. I can't help it. I don't know what
so
it is.
Good. Yeah. It's that Richie Beno thing of, like, you know, you don't have to say too much. You don't have to think you've got, you know, I mean, and this might bring us to the blue billion-pound bottle jobs thing. And the lead commentator who might be inspiring Neville to be a little more flowery with his language this season, shall we say. Sometimes just saying what has happened is brilliant, because the fact that City would be playing Premier League football next season at that point in their history after what had just happened was like, that is something else. And it didn't need sort of Nicky Weaver being compared to Nadia Comaneci or anything, because he's doing a flip around. It was just that this is what is happening and this is seismic. And yeah, I think there's, I like that sort of brevity, the sort of like the confidence to sort of let the moment breathe a little bit. And I say we have spoken on this previously. This is a long bit on the Patreon show that is basically the Rob Hawthorn fan club episode, that he tends to get them sort of things right, which is maybe why he doesn't get the really big commentary gigs that some others do. I don't know.
Yeah, there's one that stands out for me, and it's I didn't use it in the feature because it didn't really.
Because you want to talk about it now?
I want to talk about it now. Yeah, but also it doesn't really flow because they lost the game ultimately. It was the Hamburg game in 2008. Peter Drury on commentary for the home leg.
Do you know what? For all I've just said about Drury, he was great on the Hamburg game, wasn't he?
He was great on the Hamburg game because there was Alano hit the cross. Crossbar and from a free kick, and he shouted something like that crossbar will vibrate for half an hour just for the sheer power that he'd hit it with. when Alano's running up to take the penalty, he says, City need this, boy do they need this, Alano, and then he scores, and it's like he just nails that one. Caicedo scored to make it 2-1, and then he shouts, "It's in and it's on." And then Alano hits the post from a free kick. And it's the way he then says, "Oh, and he's hit the post this time." And it just, like, everything in that game came together, and he soundtracked the game perfectly. And yeah, so think about what you've said, Dom.
You could maybe say there, he was turning it up to 11, just reacting to what was happening in a crazy game of football in an atmosphere that is still talked about to this day. I think if we were going to do like a bingo card of things City fans say and your York away still being like house, I think I've reinvented the rules to bingo here. Anyway, Hamburg at home and Etihad atmospheres is like, it's the one that everyone always says. And yeah, he's great there. I think the thing with Peter Drury is everyone loved like all the clips and things like that from when he's commentating in America, but it's every week it can be a lot. But
yeah,
myself and my old housemate still, and this isn't the City game. Do you remember his commentary on South Africa scoring in the first game of the 2010 World Cup? They
a goal for all Africa. Yeah.
A goal, Bafana. Yeah, goal for South Africa, goal for all Africa. And then he goes, "Jabu Lila, rejoice," which is entirely unspontaneous, but do you know what? It was absolutely mega. Loved it.
Yeah, madness. Absolute madness. Right, well, that's it for this week's Blue Moon Podcast. Thank you very much for listening, and thanks also to my guests, Dom Farrell.
Thank you, mate.
And Joe Butterfield.
Cheers, thank you very much.
There is a clip of Monday's Nostalgia Show coming up. That's available now for Patreon backers. I'll be back next week to review the derby and look ahead to the dreaded trip to Anfield. See you then.
That was the Blue Moon Podcast. Please give the show a rating and a review where you can. And don't forget, you can listen without the ads by signing up to our Patreon. You'll also get an extra episode each Monday. Here's a clip of this week's.
Shea Given had been a number one. He was surprisingly dropped at the start of that season for this game. Can you remember what you thought about that at the time, Dom?
It felt great to see him there, but then you instantly think, oh God, what if he has a shocker? And it turns out he puts in a performance that is absolutely in the conversation for the best Premier League goalkeeping performance we've ever seen. Because it's 0-0, Tottenham should win 5-0. There are so many saves from this game. There's a brilliant save just before the Asuakota one, like from Jermaine Defoe at close range. He like hits on the turn. And obviously, you know, Defoe was a guy who was clinical from the goal. Absolutely lethal. That's a great save. I was wondering if I would be like doing a bit of a vibes thing of picking a long range save on a goalie. But I'm so glad the connoisseur has gone with me on the Asuakota one, because there's the idea that, you know, as a goalie, you would always back yourself to save something from 25, 30 yards out. But he absolutely welts this one, and it's swerving and dipping.
And it's deflected as well. It hit Wright Phillips. So, like the idea that the trajectory halfway through this shot changes, and he still gets up to it.
Yeah, and he's backpedaling because it's just been a corner. It's out of this world.
You can listen to more of that at patreon.com/Blue Moon Podcast. And join us again next time for another episode.